Hey Blenders, on this week's show, the trailer for Moon Knight is here. We discuss the title for Amazon's new Lord of the Rings series, and the Radio Silence guys come back to dive into deep spoilers on the new Scream.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 199 of Real Blend, a podcast that has to change its pick for Judi Dench Blend. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and on this week's show, we have a trailer for... Thank you,
just,
Kevin.
I just got that. It took me like 15 seconds.
Yes, it was. Trailer for Moon Knight is here. We have the title... for Amazon's Lord of the Rings series, and then guys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, later on in the show, the Radio Silence guys are back on Real Blend so soon after coming on to talk about Scream, but this time we have them back to discuss full-on spoilers. And so to protect most of you, we're putting this at the end of the show because we don't want anyone to stumble into it by accident. You haven't seen Scream yet, but if you have seen Scream... and a lot of you guys have seen it up to this point. This is the conversation that you guys want to listen to. It is chock full of incredible, incredible behind the scenes stuff in terms of the making of Scream and continuing this franchise. Joining us, as always, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. I still feel bad for leaving Kevin out of last week's introduction. I re-listened to that. Actually, I watched it on the YouTube and I was watching Kevin's face when he was like, I didn't get introduced.
Just felt like high school. No. Good to see you guys. And I can't wait for people. If you've seen Scream, you got to just make sure you listen to this interview. There's some insane stories in there. We actually just recorded it just before this recording of the show. So like it's we're kind of so like good. Coming off of it. So
it's going to be the most you've Scream, ever been excited over an ear. You're going to find out something about an ear and you're going to just... die. It's the craziest thing I've ever heard about an ear.
That is the voice of a belated birthday boy, Jake Hamilton.
Hey!
Who is 34, is that correct,
34.
Jakey?
34.
34 years young,
34.
Huh?
34. I was 12 when we started this podcast.
coincidentally, I was 34. It's been a really long time since then. Listen, housekeeping, if you're watching us on YouTube, hello, thanks for joining us. Go down, hit subscribe, turn on notifications, share the link to this week's episode with a friend. We've found out that a lot of people are passing us around and growing the audience. We can't tell you guys how much we appreciate that. Of course, we are available all the other places where you get your podcast needs met. And I want to talk about the Real Blend Premium. But first, I want to throw it to Gabe for some really special announcements regarding our upcoming episode 200. Gabe, take it away.
Yes. Tell us, Gabe. So this is episode 199, as you may have heard at the top of the
Gabe,
show.
What comes after 199?
Episode 200 is next week. It'll be dropping on January 28th. And we wanted to do something fun. There's a lot of fun stuff that in particular, people who watch us on YouTube will see some fun new things. There'll be a fun shift in format. We're going to move some things around, add some fun stuff. I'll let that be that. But If you want to do participate and have a little extra fun, we're going to throw a quote unquote after party on Instagram Live on the evening of the 28th. The episode will drop at the usual time in the morning, but at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, we are going to be on Cinema Blend's Instagram channel live, all four of us, to hang out with you all. And we'll answer questions. Maybe we'll have a game or something, you know, put together. It'll be kind of casual. It won't be as cool as a meetup. Won't be as cool as, you know, getting a drink and shooting the shit, as they say. But we hope that it'll be fun. And we're excited to see you. And I don't know if it goes well. Maybe we'll do this more often. Maybe we won't need 200 episodes to do that.
Also, I don't know if he's revealed this yet, but Jake's going to get a tattoo during live. The Instagram live.
Live.
Another tattoo.
Yes.
It's a Barb and Star tattoo, right?
No, it's actually...
I've got, like, Kevin's face on one side of my chest, and I've got Gabe's face on another, so I don't know what to do next. I don't know.
Edgar's prayer on the right butt cheek.
I mean, it's kind of... So,
in all seriousness, episode 200 next week, we're going to throw a fun little after party on Cinema Blend's Instagram Live, so be sure to follow Cinema Blend, and if you follow the guys, it should pop up when they join. Hop into the chat. We're going to open it up to questions. And we'll hang out and have some fun.
This is going to be a lot of fun.
I think so.
We're going to have a good time.
Yeah.
Can I drink during it?
It'll be a Friday, too, which is cool.
Well, right. Yes. That's kind of what I was thinking. Like, it's a happy hour kind of time. And we'll maybe play some games. Jake can beat the listeners in games instead of beating the hosts this time. Okay, so the weekly poll, which I'm going to throw to Jacob this time. And I asked this question because I kind of suspected this. And the results are a little bit concerning for this reason. The question was, what's the next movie that is going to bring you out to theaters? Knowing that Spider-Man No Way Home did really well, and then Scream did really well, the offerings for the end of January and early February are slim-ish, let's put it that way. Morbius moved, but I included Jackass, which is coming, Uncharted, which is a February release, and then I went as far as The Batman, which is a March release, and in fourth place I put Other, and we'll talk about that in a second. Jakey, where do you think the people went for the next movie that's going to bring them out to theaters?
That's got to be
The Batman. Yeah. It's The Batman, 62%. Other, I saw a lot of Doctor Strange Into the Multiverse of Madness, which, to me, this is why I'm saying this is concerning.
But do people realize that got pushed back?
I think they do. I think that, like, they're okay with the next movie they see in theaters being May.
But Batman, though.
I don't know if that's a slate of, you know, just a commentary on the offerings or how people feel about potentially going back to theaters. I'm still trying to figure out where we are in terms of this. I think there's some people who probably also feel that The Batman might be available on streaming. They don't realize yet that it's not going to be on HBO Max this year. And I've heard a lot of people say, like, oh, I can't wait to watch Batman on HBO Max. And that's not going to be the case. But
do you think The Batman, like, this is a strange question because I'm super excited about it and I love Matt Reeves. Is there an element to being too dark?
Nope.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm talking about visually from a perspective of, like, trailers.
Right.
Like, I think the idea of that it looks like Seven, as people have pointed out, like, there's a very dark and gritty tone to it. I'm very excited about it, no question. That, you know, Giacchino, I'm all in. There's no question about that. I'm just wondering, like, do you get a vibe that it might be a little too dark in tone?
Interesting.
For some people. I don't know. I don't know. I'm feeling
for
that
a casual
weirdness.
Audience, you're saying? For like a, yeah. For a more mainstream audience?
Yeah,
it's possible. I mean, look, we've talked at length on this show about DC's problem, you know, to compete with what Marvel has figured out how to do. And Marvel has figured out the jokier, you know, more audience friendly type things. And we'll talk about the Moon Knight trailer in a second. But somebody brought up a really interesting point about that trailer that they like it didn't end on a joke. It didn't end. The trailer didn't end on a little punchline. And they were shocked because that's such the Marvel formula, you know, that like after all the action, you end on something that Oscar Isaac says that's really funny kind of thing. And it didn't have it. And they were stunned about that. Kev, I think it's an interesting question, but I think word of mouth, if it's extremely positive, is going to power people to it regardless.
Yeah.
So
I just think like even Far From Home got into super dark territory. I mean, clearly it did. I just... There's a you know, it's another Batman film. A new Batman's playing Batman. It's like, I just wonder, like, are people, and that, one of the things we discussed in our show last week, I think Sean, you're the one who said it, like, we had like oversaturation of Batman, which I don't necessarily disagree agree with, because I feel like, you know, you could say that about any superhero or any you know, movie that out.
I read the comments underneath our YouTube channel where everybody was pointing out that the Spider-Man fan is calling Batman oversaturated. Fair enough.
I'm all in for it. It is such a dark trailer, and I just wonder aesthetically if that affects at all the where people. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying.
Apes movies are kind of dark. The Apes movies are pretty heavy. In terms of what they get into, especially the last one. Was the last one War of the Planet of the Apes?
That was Matt's, Reeves' movie.
That was a rough movie as well,
too. That's what I'm wondering. So, is it too heavy for right now? I don't know.
We shall see. Let's get to the Moon Knight trailer, which had its debut during the playoff football game, which was not much of a playoff football game at all. So kind of after that halftime, I punched out on it. I am a Marvel fan, obviously. I know a lot about Moon Knight. I don't think you guys do. Are you guys familiar with the Moon Knight character at all?
I'm not.
Good. Then I want to hear what you guys thought about the trailer, because we haven't even talked about this in the text thread. Did it get you interested at all in the show? Jake, are you curious about who this character is? Are you not on board? What do you think?
I mean, I think the number one reason I'm on board is because of Oscar Isaac. I love him as an actor. He seems really enthusiastic about this character. And that excites me. Yeah, the concept is intriguing. I think he looks interesting. I saw some pictures of what he looks like in the comics versus what he ended up looking like in the show. Yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm a little thrown off by the British accent. I'm hoping in the show, when I just hear it in its entire, I know anything taken out of context can throw someone off. So I don't want to like judge. And it's not that I necessarily think that his accent is bad. It's just not what I'm used to hearing coming out of Oscar Isaac, so it's taking me a hot second to kind of get used to it. That was sort of the only thing where I kind of had to like pause and go, wait, what's happening? No, I mean, I'm sold. I mean, I don't think the trailer did anything to like, you know, turn the knob in terms of like, you know, upping my excitement a little bit. I'm about sort of exactly where I was before I saw the trailer. It's kind of like, okay, cool. But it didn't turn it down, which is good.
Okay. Kev, how about you? You've been a little bit hot and cold in terms of the Marvel shows.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, again, this goes back to the quote-unquote oversaturation conversation we were just having. I don't necessarily love the Marvel series, except for Loki, to be honest with you. WandaVision promisingly started out, you know, the first three episodes I loved. I didn't like it after that. Wasn't a fan of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. You know, I didn't even finish Hawkeye. And that's, you know, that's not really, I can't really give you my critique of that, because I didn't finish it. I just wasn't interested enough to finish it, is my point. And I don't know. I mean, Oscar Isaac is my selling point here. I mean, I think the guy just chooses incredible and interesting work. I mean, clearly Dune, even with the card counter, even if the film wasn't great, I just find that he's making some very interesting choices. I'm inside Llewyn Davis, obviously. He is a fascinating actor. I rewatched Annihilation recently. He's great in that. So I think in my mind, I'm thinking about Oscar Isaac choosing to do this and going, is this good? And I feel like Oscar Isaac is on some level where he looks at the material, doesn't take it for a paycheck. So in all honesty, like, that's the one reason why I'm interested, is the fact that he's involved. And I think that every choice he's made so far as an actor, whether the movie was great or not so great, has been interesting to me. And I've found his path kind of like Benedict Cumberbatch. I've always found his choices to be fascinating, too. And I'm kind of, you know, I would love a Doctor Strange series, obviously. But, you know, they're not going to do that with the main. I guess they would do it with the main characters. I don't know. But, you know, we'll see.
I don't know how they determine who gets a movie and who gets a show. You know,
yeah, like, is it like Wanda's a big character. And so obviously so is Vision. But in Falcon and Winter Soldier, but you're not seeing an Iron Man series. You're not seeing a Cap series, or I guess.
Yeah,
that's a Cap series. Well, I mean,
yeah,
technically Falcon and the Winter Soldier
is a Cap series.
It's true. Yeah, good point.
So this is the point where I'm going to bring up Ethan Hawke telling us in his interview, which you can hear on Real Blend, that he a little bit went over to Marvel just because that's where the game is being played right now. And I hope that it's more so the material also. He did talk very highly about his experiences with them over there and said he enjoyed what they were doing. But this brings up a larger point that I kind of wanted to bring up in terms of, are we getting to a point with the Marvel shows and the Star Wars shows, the Disney Plus shows in general, the streaming shows, where the two biggest franchises currently operating right now, which would I would argue is Marvel and Star Wars, that are doing a lot of their stuff on television, I'm losing interest in them a tad. I'm more invested in the Marvel stuff because I do care about those characters. But I'm coming over to Kevin's side in that there wasn't the urgency, you know, when a new episode of Hawkeye dropped. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'll watch it. That's cool.
I didn't even finish it.
And neither of you finished it. And I'm a little bit at the point with the Boba Fett show now where I'm two episodes that have passed that I haven't. There's one that dropped today. I haven't seen it, and I haven't seen the one previous to it. And each time I'm on the couch and I'm like, shouldn't I? I'm just not that compelled to do it. So I don't. Are we getting to a point where they're turning out so many of these shows that, and because it's free and it's right there, and if you want to watch it, you can. But if you don't want to, it's easier to skip. How do you guys feel about that?
I would argue that aside from Loki, do any of these shows have any ramifications in the story world of the movies? And I understand that they exist.
Wanda does for sure.
Yeah, but would you have had to watch all of WandaVision to understand a story point that could have been explained in the beginning of a movie?
I think Multiverse of Madness is going to explain like WandaVision in two lines.
Yes, I think that that's what they're playing is. And I think the Multiverse of Madness will sort of set that stage because everything up to this point hasn't really touched on the series. But I do think that they're going to have to make it interesting for people who aren't going to watch the series. Like it has to make sense for people who are just watching the movies because they've got this massive audience. They don't just have giant Marvel fans. They have, you know, mom and pops who go to three movies a year and they go to the Marvel movies and they're not going to get a Disney Plus subscription just to watch more Marvel shows necessarily. Yeah. So
don't you feel like the movies are A-list and the shows seem more B-list? Yes. I don't mean that badly because I just feel like at the end of the day, if you're really going to make a great movie out of a great story with great story points that change the universe, you're going to put it into a movie.
I feel like
the shows kind of get the scraps.
This is why I think you guys are sleeping on Hawkeye and why I really like Hawkeye is because Hawkeye is not trying to break open the Marvel universe.
I've
said this before on the show. It feels like a one-off. It introduces characters and it sets the stage for things to come. The characters are great in it. The actors who are portraying them are doing A-class work. But the story
I'm not
itself.
Interested enough in Hawkeye to watch a whole series on.
But my point is, I think your perspective that you're coming to them is not unfair, but it's your expectations are too high. Like Hawkeye is a story about can Dad make it home for Christmas in time? It's a Christmas story. Can Dad make it home for Christmas? But the problems that he's trying to navigate to get home for Christmas are Hawkeye problems, and that's fun. And I think if you just go into them of like, I just want to spend more time with the characters, mm-hmm. then you'll enjoy it. But if you're not interested in the character, then yeah, I would say don't watch it. Because I think the series themselves are just there to either introduce new characters or give interesting stories for the characters that already exist.
For sure. It's a level of investment as well, too. Because like, yes, you're right. You might not care who Kate Bishop is, right? Like Hailee Steinfeld could show up in the next whatever movie. And you might for 5 minutes be like, who is this character? But you would go along with the story kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. But if you are invested in the world, you want to see her origin story. You want to see, and it just happened to play out in a television show necessarily.
Sean, I do want to ask you because you know this character more than anybody. Am I reading too much into it that it's coming out at the end of February, if they do the 2-episode release and then weekly, it's leading right up to Doctor Strange's release? Is there any way that those characters interact or that those stories interact?
The Moon Knight one?
And end of Moon Knight. Moon Knight will end.
No, I don't think so because originally when you, well, that's hard because there have been so many rewrites for Doctor Strange, but Doctor Strange was supposed to come out originally before Spider-Man No Way Home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So unless they are reworking the beginning of Doctor Strange to fit the Moon Knight deal, and look, they could be doing that. That could be what the reshoots are for.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think they have to. I think they can operate. I think that sounds very similar to when everybody was like, ooh, Spider-Man swinging over Rockefeller Center in the snow. He's going to be in the Hawkeye finale. And I'm sure the showrunners are like, we can't do that. Like, that's and impossible to plan.
The last thing I wanted to run by you, because I don't totally know this character, but I saw people online talking about it, is the potential for Kit Harington's character from Eternals to show up in this storyline.
I mean, he doesn't in the Moon Knight comics, but that's not out of the realm of possibility.
I saw people kind of pitching that as that character coming in, because what's interesting about this series is that there's seemingly no overlap of like an existing character, where like every other series has had their Wanda or their Loki or their
Falcon. So just to bring this up really quickly, like PJ watched the Moon Knight trailer and he is like, they recast that guy already? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, I thought this is who Kit Harington is supposed to play at the end of Eternals. And I'm like, no, that's Black Knight. And this is Moon Knight. And then I just saw PJ's eyes glaze over. So there's confusion, even on people who pay attention beyond a surface level. Yeah, right. He was like, I thought that this guy picked up a sword in the end of Eternals. And I was like, no, this is a different guy. So we'll see how it plays out. I'm talking about people who are glancing over or eyes are glazing over because of a... relative disinterest in the franchise. Jake, I'm going to pass it to you to discuss your anticipation level for Amazon's The Lord of the Rings of Power.
I mean, you know, I will say I am excited. They announced, the title is terrible. It's a horrible, horrible title. But
what if they just called it Rings of Power? Would that be
okay? That's what it should be.
Okay.
Because basically my understanding is that the plot of this series is going to be sort of what the prologue of Fellowship was. That first 10 minutes where Cate Blanchett is sort of doing the voiceover narration and is explaining the dispersion of the rings and how they went to the different people. And that's basically what this show is going to be. I think that's interesting because now I don't really, aside from that opening 10 minutes of Fellowship, I don't really know the details of that story and what happened. So it'll be nice to watch a show and not know every single beat. Whenever they announced that this was going to be a series, it was sort of like, well, I know what happens. Like, why am I going to give you 8 years of my life to tell me a story that I already watched before?
Sure.
So in that sense, it's going to be great. Amazon is pumping, did I read somewhere, like nearly $1 billion, like billion with a B, into this show.
I read it was the most expensive TV show ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I'm like literally excited to actually see it. Cool. Let's support Jeff Bezos. Things, you know, he needs
Does
things.
Does Amazon just not have
Jeffrey Bezos?
Like they need a place to dump money. Is that really like $1 billion?
He's laundering money on
the weirdest money laundering scheme ever.
Literally has no other place to put all of his money.
I did walk up to Jeff Bezos one time at a Star Wars premiere and I said, thank you for Amazon Prime. That did happen.
That is the thing that actually happened.
I do like Amazon Prime.
It's great. No, it's terrific.
I said, thank you.
You can get stuff delivered the same day if you ordered early enough. It's amazing. Now, we are not sponsored by Amazon in any way, shape, or form.
If I had seen Bo Burnham's Inside, I would have started singing Jeffrey Bezos to him.
Kevin, what did you love about the title treatment? You loved the fact that they did this all practically.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the title's bad, unfortunately, and I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan, and it makes me sad to say that. After the Hobbit films, which I didn't hate as much as everybody else did, I'm kind of in a weird sense of, like, I love the Jackson's original trilogy so much that I don't know that there's more of it that I need. That being said, I love the first three so much that I'm 100% grateful to go back into the world. In terms of the title treatment that you guys are talking about, there's the trailer that came out today. It's like they're pouring the molten lava or whatever
to
that
create
stuff is.
The rings. Yeah,
yeah. And they did it practically, because weirdly enough, I would argue it almost looks CG in the final product, but then when they show you the behind the scenes, they use like this Phantom Flex camera, this 4K Phantom Flex camera that would like swing down as they were pouring it, and they were like washing water to make this like smoke. The behind the scenes footage is even cooler than the actual release.
I'm honestly curious if they released that footage just because they saw the product and they were like, this doesn't even look real. Like, we need to let people know that we made this.
Like, oh, I didn't see that.
I don't want to plug another site, but I think IGN had the video.
IGN had the exclusive.
And, like, it's it's crazy because they cut back and forth between the final product and then the filming, and the final product looks so CG, and I'm like, what happened here? They did all this really cool, like, sweeping camera work and, like, really pouring it in, and it kind of was, like, made me upset. I was like, how did all that work went into it? It looked like a computer-generated effect. So, I'm of course, I'm going to watch it. I don't know how I feel about it yet because I'm so... I thought, like, I was sitting here thinking I wanted more Lord of the Rings content. Like, I love the original trilogy, and Hobbits were fine, but I'm just kind of like, I've kind of moved on from that. But, you know, I'll dive back into Tolkien's world. I mean, yeah, I'm down.
Well, I'm here to say that I'm back on board with this. As someone who doesn't necessarily love this franchise...
Of course you are.
I'm going to give it a shot. Well, what I'm saying is I'm going to give it a shot.
So you watch three of the greatest films of all time, and you're like, no, thank you.
You watch
a trailer where molten lava is rolling around on some wood, and you're like, I'm sold. I'm in.
I didn't say I was sold. But what I'm saying is I'm behind the idea of fans of a franchise carrying on the legacy beyond... Like, I'm glad it's not Peter Jackson, right? I'm glad in a way, because I think... We needed a fresh voice. We needed a new voice to come in and maybe try to adapt these. Listen, I know that you're... Yeah, I know, Gabe. I'm actually leaning towards something. It makes no sense
what you're saying. Like, you're talking about the a master filmmaker who made three masterpieces and you didn't like any of them.
Right.
And now you want to watch an Amazon series about
a
the same world.
$1 billion Amazon series.
So what? Who cares how much the cost?
What if what if the new showrunners are terrific? What if they...
Well, Peter Jackson is terrific.
You saw The Hobbit. All three of them.
But wait, James Cameron made
Avatar.
I don't understand. You don't like Lord of the Rings.
It makes no sense.
And Lord of the Rings is as good as Lord of the Rings will ever be.
But Jake, this is the Lord of the Rings. The Rings of Power.
The Rings of Power. But listen, one of the things that's most annoying about the Lord of the Rings are the hobbits. So if this show does not have hobbits...
Oh my God, you are the hobbits of Real Blend.
All the other things are more exciting.
Like, Sean, I don't, what you're saying makes no sense.
You don't like the thought of a second breakfast?
That's like me watching...
Is
like,
that a joke
like
from the franchise?
The Hobbits eat a second breakfast.
That's like me watching the best Marvel movies.
Yeah.
And then being like, I don't know, that's not really my thing. Hawkeye, though, I'm in.
Yeah, Jake's like, I hated Infinity War and Endgame and Civil War and Winter Soldier, but I can't wait for Hawkeye.
Give me some of that Hawkeye action.
Because of Vera Farmiga.
Are the Marvel equivalent to Hobbits the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yes, they would be.
Are they the hobbits in the Marvel?
I think that would be very fair.
Aww.
Yes.
Yeah. What? Who's Gandalf?
Downey?
Probably Downey.
I mean, technically, there's only one wizard.
But I mean, all right. There's two movies that are opening this week, and we haven't seen either of them, so we'll mention them briefly.
We're a movie podcast.
Yeah, well, there, you know, you got to get them in front of us. One is called Redeeming Love, I think is on Netflix. And the other is called The King's Daughter, which is not a Matthew Vaughn spinoff to the King's Man franchise. You can find both of them this week out there.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, so speaking of directors who have taken charge of a franchise that we love, this is part of why I was mentioning this with Amazon and The Lord of the Rings, is that every once in a while you get a filmmaking team who comes around and dives back into a property that we enjoy and lets us see it from a different perspective, the way that the Radio Silence guys did with Scream. And so without further ado, I want to throw it right to our, listen, very, 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 very spoiler-filled conversation with Matt and Tyler, the co-directors of Scream, and their producer, Chad, who joins them as well, too. They go by Radio Silence. They're great guys who came on the show to talk about the movie. They said they would come back and talk spoilers and held on to that promise. They did. And this is a great, great conversation. You guys are going to love this one. It's the guys from Radio Silence on Real Blend.
First of all, welcome back to Real Blend. It's an honor to have all of you back on the show. Obviously, congratulations on your incredible number one opening weekend. I mean, dethroning Spider-Man. I mean, it's a huge deal, and obviously it's great to see the power of this franchise still living all these years later. I know Wes Craven, I don't know him, but I feel like he'd be very proud to see this film still going, and I know his work will live on forever, even after his passing, so it's nice to talk to you guys about this incredible project. But real fast, just to get a timestamp from you guys as to where we are right now, we're talking to you on Wednesday after your film came out. You're number one in the country right now. Can you talk about kind of what that feels like and with the success of it and the critical reaction to it and what the fans have been saying to you guys?
I think it's better than any of us expected. You know, I think our job is to fall in love with something at the early stage, and then you hopefully keep as much of the thing that you love about it present throughout the process. And you know, your job is to kind of protect all of those things and make sure as many of them ultimately make it to the final product as you can. And so to be at the stage where people are seeing it and responding and that they understand it and that they love all of the tones that make a Scream movie. I think, you know, speaking for us, the writers, the producers, I think we're all just over the moon thrilled with it.
Man. That's awesome. Guys, so obviously we get the opportunity to dive into spoilers with you guys, which we really wanted to last time, but we held back. But now we're jumping into the deep into the pool.
I'm gonna
start off with a big one. There were a lot of fans, myself included, who really thought that the killer could be one of, if not multiple, of the legacy characters. Talking, Sidney or Gale or Dewey.
I thought it was gonna be Sidney.
A lot of people thought it was gonna be Sidney. Yeah. And I'm curious as to, you know, you guys are obviously you're deep in the world of Scream, but you're also fans. Do you think that the legacy killers should be or ever could be the killers of a Scream movie?
That's insanely interesting, and I've like never really actually went down that path as to how this does affect them, right? Because they've obviously been through more trauma than any normal human being goes through in an entire life. So they definitely have grudges out there that they could possibly go down that with. But to me, no. I like, you know, honestly, there are heroes. They're people who they kill for good, if that is a thing. When they do kill somebody, they give the people their comeuppance.
Sid's body count is pretty high.
Pretty soon. I mean, like, honestly, like, yeah, Gale's too is very, very high. But if I were to go, I would probably go Gale first and then Sidney, because I don't think Sidney would really have it in her. Gale, like, if you really dig deep down a little
Chad
bit.
Chad fan fiction right now.
Yeah. get to the message board quick, Chad.
Right. Yeah. But I don't know. But besides that it's such a, like, a far-reaching thought that
I don't know, but I love that you guys asked that question, because I think what that shows us and that I love so dearly is that you expect the movie to take a risk, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what is like, it is intrinsic to the experience of watching one of these movies, that the second you have an expectation, you also have to assume that the movie is aware of that expectation and is going to fuck with it in some way. And also just like, I love that you want the entertainment to do that thing. Right. And specifically a Scream movie, it's gotta be willing to go to a place that is maybe a little uncomfortable and difficult. Yeah. And hopefully we achieve that in some different ways, but mm-hmm. that's a really interesting question.
It's funny. The only reason I ever thought it might be Sidney, just piggybacking off of Jake, is if you go back to Scream 1, they're in that bathroom with the two girls talking about why Sidney would be the killer. And I was like, that'd be a really cool thing. If, like you said, like the trauma all over these years, and that would ended up being, but I'm glad it wasn't. But to Jake's point, that's kind of what we were talking about in our text threads. So,
well, and I want to sort of piggyback off of that too, because you guys talk about the movie being willing to take risks or set our expectations. And I think the movie does that really early on when Jenna's character survives the opening scene.
Right.
And I want you guys to be able to talk about
awesome.
The significance of that, because once she survived, I think that's when I realized, oh, anything can happen here. And Great. We're really not playing by the rules.
I mean, that's exactly, that was in the script. All credit to Guy and Jamie for that. That was in the script. And we had the exact same experience you had. When we got to that on page 12 or whatever, it was like, oh, great. All bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen now. And you know, for us, it was a great inversion of the Drew Barrymore scene where you like get so attached and you're like, there's no way she's going to die. And then she does. And also on a very selfish note, we cast Jenna Ortega, who's one of the greatest actors that's alive. Right. So we now hopefully get to work with her again on another Scream movie. But yeah, I think it was Guy and Jamie really understanding that in order for Scream to work, and Tyler, you were just alluding to this, Scream needs to take chances, it needs to take risks, and it needs to play with your expectations so that it can subvert them. And that's the first time in this movie that it really does that, right? Mm. And I mean, yeah, we had the same reaction. But honest question for all three of you, did any of you know that she was going to survive even a little bit, or was it
No.
Totally shocked.
Halfway through the scene, I did look at my wife and say, what if she survives this? How cool would that be?
That's all I said. Love it.
That's all I said.
Because I remember that is like, and I think the kind of crazy thing is that, you know, for us, because we had a fear in reading it that, oh, is Ghostface going to feel like he's ineffective, right? That he's not as brutal and scary. And then you get to the moment where the big reveal happens, you go, fuck, it's all part of a plan. Like, it's all by design. And we loved that was so that our killers were, that had that level of manipulation. They were that meta in the story of the movie. That for us was just like, we were so hooked.
They knew where to stab her exactly right so that she wouldn't actually die.
God. And that led to one of the best scenes in the film, which is the wheelchair scene, which I still think is one of the most, like, I literally feel that pain in my body when she's like turning the wheels. And I'm like, oh my God, you feel every piece of it.
I think the script says slowest escape in history or something like that. That was all they said. And we're like, all right, cool. Like, we really got to milk this one out.
That's awesome.
There was this like whole, like, everyone, the fans, you know, when we were gearing up to make this, there was this call of like, do a chase scene. And we were like, fuck it. All right. We're going to give you the craziest, weirdest subversion of a chase scene you've ever seen.
God, that was awesome. This is going to be like a two-part question, but it's still within the same realm of the same question. So I want to talk about the art of killing a legacy character, obviously, like Dewey. I mean, this sounds weird to say, but I feel like he gets a great death scene. I know it sounds strange to say that, but like, I feel like when the line it's an honor, I'm like, he got the greatest type of death scene that he deserved after being in this franchise for so long. I wanted to ask you about that scene in particular. Did you have other ideas of how to kill him off? Was it always the two knives going in and up in the front and the back? And then later on in the film, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we understand that Mikey is the killer in that moment. It's not Jack, which I find interesting because the killer in that moment does look larger than Mikey.
Very large.
So can you guys talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I'll say that with, you know, with Dewey's death, I mean, it was something that we were obviously heartbroken when we read the script. We also just had this feeling in our guts that it was the right thing to do, right? That structurally the movie needs an engine at that point.
Stakes.
And it needs stakes at that
point.
And you have to get Sid back to Woodsboro. And that's the way to do it, right? Is to call on like the loss of a legacy character. But shooting it was, you know, there was definitely a level of reverence and respect. We understood going into it how just the gravity of what that was. On the page, it was always two blades. We wanted it to feel iconic. We also knew after stabbing Dewey so many times in the previous movies that it was gonna take more. To take him out. We sort of loved that there's like the method of killing him, like you said, is also an expression of his invincibility and of his heroism to a certain extent. And then I think at the end of the day, the other thing that we really loved about that sequence that was on the page, and I think we're really pleased with how it ultimately plays in the movie is, you know, there's more to that scene than just like a brutal, cruel murder. Gail is a part of that scene, right? With the phone call and that he kind of gets to say goodbye to her and connect with her in one final moment. And there's a little bit of hope at the end of his run. All of those ingredients, thankfully, hearing you say that it feels it feels heroic and it feels grand, yeah, and like the proper sort of send off for his, you know, for that character. That means the world to us. We were hoping to achieve that, and we love that's present at all. Yeah, and then guys, you want to talk about Amber?
I was going to jump into like just the production value around what was going on there real quick too, because like the shelving that Ghostface smashes through that he pops up out of is like these shelves of these like cuddly soft like stuffed animals, right? It is.
I've got some here.
That is Dewey, and you know that you love that. And then the only thing that remains in the shelves after is like a sign that's hanging there, and it says thank you. And it was like something like that, you know, the H fell off of one of the banners, but it's just like, you know, getting in all those layers to make sure that we respectfully send Dewey off. Amber is, go ahead, Matt. You can go ahead.
Yeah. I'm curious about this.
It's a movie, guys. It's fucking fun.
No judgment. We were just curious.
No, this is really fun. I joking aside, this is actually really fun to talk about because it's something that we, stepping into this, we're like, how do you do that? You know, and again, if you look at Ghostface is always Ghostface, right? You have Jill and you have Matthew Lillard. Mm. I don't know Emma Roberts, but I assume she's not as tall as Matthew Lillard. and you know, and one of the things that I think Nev said to us when we were kind of going, because even when we were in pre-production, we were debating like, well, what do we do? How do we handle this? And you know, we had solves.
When we cast Jack and Amber and Mikey, we were like, there is a disparity, a height disparity between.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we tried to make it seem like where you couldn't tell exactly what height everybody is. You know, obviously with Jack, that's a little hard because he's a giant. But it was, you know, Nev said something that really stuck with us is that she's like, you know, Ghostface, the way that they had always talked about is that Ghostface is, when you put on the Ghostface costume, you become Ghostface, not the other way around. That it's almost like a superhero, cool. You know? So she was like, you don't worry about it so much, you know, it's not about who's in it as much as it being Ghostface. And I think for us, that really gave us the leeway to be like, okay, cool. We can just accept that this is Ghostface. Yes, we get it. We joked about it a lot. Like, is there a way to even poke fun at it? Which that line didn't make it in the movie, right? We had a line where when Jack's in the kitchen and he's ranting about the problems, he was like, and the killers are all different heights. And it was just, it felt like a little,
I think it's funny.
It is funny.
There's a lot of shit in that scene that is very funny. That just didn't make it for, you know, pacing issues, but that kitchen sequence is like cut in half just for, you know, you have to keep it on the rails, but there's a lot of great little moments like that.
Oh, that's cool. Awesome.
Thank you for answering that. We were just thinking about it. We were curious. So,
no, and fun fact that both the two stuntmen, we had two stuntmen who played Ghostface throughout the whole movie, and they're both 5'10.
Oh, which is like right in the middle.
That's my height.
Yeah. Right in the middle.
That's my height. I'm Ghostface sized. So I'm a bit of a nerdy question for you. And it's regards to Sam's family, and obviously her father is Billy Loomis. One, is Sam aware that her grandmother is a serial killer as well? And was there ever talks of like maybe her seeing Laurie Metcalf? And then also, who is Sam's mother? Because in theory, it would potentially be someone who they were going to high school with at the time. And there is a fan theory floating around that it's the second girl in the bathroom who is jealous of Sydney and says something about that's like, oh, cool. It's like Sydney. It's like her. She has her own bubble butt boyfriend or something like that. A lot of people think that could be Sam's mom.
Love that fan theory.
Confirm. Steer into it. I saw one too about that. It could be the two girls or one of the two girls at the video store that Billy's talking to and Matthew Lillard and Jamie Kennedy have that conversation. All interesting. Cool.
I mean, I think we love the idea that there's an off-screen story with Sam's family. At the end of the day, we felt like the more we kind of let air into the sister story, the less the movie was about the two sisters. So, you know, we ultimately ended up just really focusing things in on the two of them. I also remember there was Christina Carpenter, the mom, was in the script, to a slightly larger degree in one of the drafts.
She had a scene.
And it felt like her character was the cell phone in the horror movie that kind of made all of the stuff sort of harder to make scary and make tense. Like having a character that could kind of come in at any moment, it always felt like it was an obstacle that wasn't enhancing ultimately the story between those two characters. But we love that there's more of that family life that exists. And that is honestly, I mean, there are ingredients to play with in that, that we think could be really fun moving forward.
Right. Well, and not unlike calling out the height of the killers in the kitchen scene. We did have a line where Richie's character was like, your father and your grandmother were serial killers. And
he
and
said,
that was
Sydney
another...
killed your father and your grandmother.
Yeah. But we took that out just to really focus it in on the Billy of it all. Nice. And for clarity for everybody, because then okay. People would be like, if people weren't
Who's
familiar
the grandma?
With Scream 2,
yeah.
They're like, what the?
I'm sorry, there's a grandma serial killer in this movie?
Well, that's a perfect transition, because I'm pretty sure you guys have a line in the script, too, that calls Billy and Stu the first killers or the starters of this. Did you deliberately remove Roman? Is Roman Bridger out of this continuity? Where is Scream 3 in all this?
It's a really solid question. It's a really, really solid. It's funny you bring that up, because I was literally watching Scream 3 a couple nights ago, and I was like, does this count? And I don't know, guys, jump in, but I feel like in the Screams that we all know and love, Billy and Stu started this, you know,
right, yes.
That,
yes.
That, and again, it's weird that we're making a requel that has retcon stuff happening in it, and which feels kind of like what Roman was, right? It was this thing that happened before that nobody knew about.
Yeah.
But I do think you may have just figured out the one thing that we, on purpose or not, just kind of ignored.
Right? Oh, and I'm okay with it.
Well, I think part of it too is just that, like, the start of the saga for all of us, you know, as
fans,
and is so specific to those two killers.
Hmm. I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
So I was sitting next
Justice
to my wife.
Justice for Roman. We are not Roman deniers.
Yeah, we love Roman, by the way.
Roman is as much a part of this as anybody.
There's a hashtag right now. Justice for Roman.
One of the things I found interesting as I was watching the film, I mean, it's obviously hard not to think about Arquette and Cox's real life relationship, in the sense that the characters are talking as if they've broken up and they're in scenes together. But then I read somewhere that the photos that were used in the movie of their relationship were actual photos of their real relationship. So that just made me understand that they were just cool with dealing with that situation as part of the story. And obviously that's kind of what happened in the world of the story. Is that a touchy thing to mess with? Like, do you go to them and say, like, you know, we're going to play with this idea. Your characters are going through this. You know, we're going to have photos of your, or did they offer up their own photos? I'm not trying to ask like a TMZ type question. I'm actually just genuinely curious about how that was handled. Cause it does, some of the lines hit close cause you know, they were together.
I mean, look, we reached out. And it's certainly with all the sensitivity that you would expect, you know, reaching into a decades long relationship that started with these movies. So we were very sensitive and very aware of just how personal that connection is on screen and off screen. And they were so game. They are dear, dear friends. They really genuinely love each other. And I think they also understood on a, not only just a personal kind of character level, how valuable it was to excavate that, you know, on screen, but I also think they understand the weird meta value of their relationship, how it's tracked with these movies. And then this one being, you know, being what it is, and them kind of dealing with the past four movies and where they're sort of at in their lives, and have they grown apart? Are they close? And there's real love there, but it was all very, very much a part of that scene. And I remember in shooting that scene, there were a couple of takes right at the beginning where they were very clearly like, after we'd cut cameras, and they were like, that one was for us having the experience together on set.
Oh, wow.
As you know, as characters whose lives are a reflection, you know, are reflected in this script and in this movie, we're going to get it to a place, but like, it's going to be a process to like get to that moment. And it was, I'll never forget that day, guys. We were all sitting around the monitors, just like crying and like, holy fuck, like what a moment, what a wild thing to get to see happen, you know, on screen.
They really brought it all. It was incredibly personal. They were, so generous with us like that. Like,
so did you wrap David on his death? Was that his last scene, or did he shoot that earlier in the process?
On Dewey's the scene death? We were just talking about actually was his last.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I want to talk about bringing Skeet back, which was a surprise. Like, I think my jaw dropped. My jaw still might be in the theater whenever I saw it. Like, I just never something. One, I thought it looked fantastic. I just want to talk about sort of the conversation of getting him on the phone and explaining, hey, this character that died 25 years ago, we're going to need you to play this guy again, and we're going to need you to look like you did in high school. And just how perfectly you guys...
That part was easy, because he's incredibly good-looking.
That's true. That's true.
He looks hair, exactly
you nailed that
90s same.
Hair again.
Like, and the shirt, the blood, the stains,
everything.
Everything
looks the same. Just like the process of doing that and how excited I'm assuming he was to bring Billy back, something I'm assuming he never thought he was going to get to do again.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think Skeet's jaw dropped, too, when he got the phone call saying, hey, do you want to be in Scream? And he's like, wait a second, what year is this? What's happening? What's going on? But getting him to set was just very, very special. Like, we shot with him for one day, and it was our very last day of production. So we did the green screen stuff and everything like that, too. But even just getting him to look that way for a certain moment, for one day, he said it was the first time he actually went fully shaved in 3 years or something. Like, so very clean shave, first time in 3 years. And we looked at him and we're like, oh my gosh, you look just like Billy. It's like, this is amazing. And then the process for his hair too. Skeet's natural hair is a little bit curly and he does, there you go. And
oh, it doesn't really that's look. So cool.
That's amazing. That's so cool.
Really great.
Oh.
So we had to go into the hair and makeup trailer for about an hour to get his hair straightened as well. And by the time he came back to set, we're like, oh gosh, you know, let's get the blood on the shirt. Let's get everything going. And let's really make that look, you know, materialize. Cause we did talk about a couple different ways that we could like see him in Sam's visions, right? Like, what is her memories of him? Obviously she's never met him. So we decided to go with like crime scene photos. That would be how she would imagine her dad, because that would be all that she kind of did see of him, or like that was the most influential.
No pictures were taken of Billy Loomis. Of him.
It was the 90s.
We used the glamour shot from the movie in the Mindy speech scene where he's looking pretty nice and he's glowing like a vampire from
nice.
Twilight. It's a pretty great photo.
He did shoot a bunch of crime scene photos though, where we redressed the house in the aftermath of Billy and Stu's death, because they were originally going to appear on the screen in the Mindy monologue scene. There were going to be crime scene photos of the original house, and that was a particularly fucking crazy meta moment where we were Billy, you know, Skeet was on the ground in the hallway. We dressed it props exactly where they are at the end of the movie, feathers everywhere from him, you know, stabbing, tearing open the couch. And it was like such a weird time capsule to have what? 25 years later, the actor that, you know, is Billy there. It was just so, so wild and crazy.
Please tell me you use corn syrup.
But you know what we did do is that, you know, we went around and we threw all the pillow feathers everywhere, but he told us that he did that on the first take, just kind of, it wasn't like a direction, it wasn't in the script, he just did it. And then apparently Wes Craven was like, I love it. And then Skeet was like, shit, now I have to do this every time and I'm covered in feathers for the rest of the movie.
All right. So in our last conversation, you guys dropped a bombshell on us and we cut it out of the interview, and it was the audio cameos of everybody who died in a Scream, the toast to Wes. So I would love now for you guys to elaborate on whose idea it was and how you even go about doing it. Do you actually, like, how long does it take to reach out to each of the different people and have them record this cameo? Because it's a tremendous idea.
Thank you. I mean, we had the idea in post, I believe.
Pretty early in post, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, the idea that was baked into the script, which was fantastic, was like, let's have a party literally for Wes in the movie, you know, and have a toast to Wes in the movie, which, of course, if someone watches the movie not knowing who Wes Craven is, they might not, it'll still just go right over their heads. But like, we thought it was so special. And so when we got to post and we started doing ADR, we were like, let's just get everybody. So we called.
Oh, love that.
And or reached out to people through friends who knew people, a pretty extensive list.
Yeah.
and had that. And a lot of those people did other little voice cameos for us too. But the in the Four West one, it was it's like almost the entire original cast, including Henry Winkler, all of our cast. Who are some other fun ones? Julie Plec.
Julie Plec.
Obviously, Patrick Lussier.
His widow is in it.
Yeah,
we had Adam Brody and Hayden.
Oh wow,
Adam Brody and Hayden. I'm peeking at our list, guys. Vamp for a second.
Yeah, and by the way, I will also say the other when you're reaching out to those people, you know, we offered the opportunity to do some other voice cameo stuff, and you know, like Drew is the voice of the principal when we're booming down at the high school. Matthew Lillard is the voice of Flamethrower Ghostface and has a line at the house party at the end. Jamie Kennedy does the line. Someone's goofy ass dad is kicking us out. we also wanted them to be as much like a part of the movie as possible. And they were so down. I mean, it was like, we had no problem getting any of them.
Everybody got back to us. Yeah, right away.
I mean, Matt Lillard's line at the house was cool house Freeman, which was nice because it was his house in the original.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was a really early idea too. That was another one of those, a lot of like the Flamethrower Ghostface. That was like an early, like in joke with us and Guy and Jamie being like, ah, that'd be really funny. The fact that it actually happened and now exists is very weird.
To Sean's question,
Marco Beltrami was another one. Just to get out there.
That's Beltrami's awesome. In there. That's awesome. Before I get to my question, just follow up on something Sean just asked. Like, when you had them all recorded, did they all do it from home or something and just text it to you guys?
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Technology. Yeah.
Wow. And then you have an amazing sound team that, like, builds it, puts it in the world, and makes it sound incredible.
That's insane.
I literally figured when you guys told us about the toast, I was like, I backpedaled and I was like, they created that character named Wes just so they could kill him off to have a party, to have the toast, to have the cameo.
I think you're kind of right. I mean,
that's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Last time, so going off of what Sean was just saying, last time we talked to you, you guys dropped that bombshell. And then as we were hanging up, I asked you a quick question and I wanted to like expand on it because I think you guys remember now, but one of my favorite movies ever is Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it's hard not to think about Mikey's death being coincidentally the same, considering she's torched just like their character was in Hollywood. Now, I know you guys told us at that point that it was not an homage, but I guess in the idea of Scream, you could think of it as an homage because it's the word torch. And like, but, you know, that character is interesting. So when you guys were filming it, did you know? You had seen Hollywood, I'm imagining, at that point.
Was it brought up on set?
Like, did Mikey go, hey, guys, this is kind of similar to how DiCaprio kills me in Hollywood?
I mean, we knew it when we cast her, that it was, and we even had the conversation. We were like, is this weird? And then ultimately decided that even if you read it as homage, it still works in the universe of Scream. Like, it still is just a fun texture that is a reference to a movie that we love dearly and also really love Mikey in. And it's also for us just, I think, a hilarious story that Mikey has now done two major movies. she dies by fire and bug.
But Sydney's line of enjoy that torch is such a, it's a, first, a tremendous delivery, you know, but it also says so much to this idea of these legacy characters, you know, and the notion that they have to pass the baton to another generation. It's a great line.
Guy and Jamie, that was like one of those ones again, like when we're reading it for the first time, you get to that moment and you go, oh, fuck, you guys have outdone yourselves. That's great.
And it's such a movie line. It's a line that it's one of those that you would never say in real life. But as a character in a movie that's about movies, it like just fits. It's one of those, the context of it is just, is perfect.
Well, Sydney's had a lot of opportunities.
It circles back to the thing we were talking to earlier about Amber. It's like part of what makes Scream so wonderful is that you're aware that you're watching a movie that is aware of movies and knows movies and loves movies as much as we all do. So the things like when we're talking about Amber being, you know, after killing Dewey, like those things, you're like, yeah, that's a part of movies and that's fun. And that's part of the love letter. You know, it's like, it's just, I think it's what we love about Scream so much and why I think so many people, one of the million reasons people are so connected to the Scream franchise And so to have that conversation, like what you're talking about, it's just awesome. It just kind of keeps going.
It's really fun. Yeah, and I remember just to talking about Mikey a little bit more, like her coming in covered in a shroud. So the first time we got to see the makeup of after effect of when she was on fire. And first of all, she was like, I can't believe I'm doing this again, which was like the first thing she said. The second thing we were able to do was like look at like the design of the makeup that that our special effects makeup team did for her. And they gave her a Freddy Krueger ear as one more nod to Wes. So
Rick
it's poor, the exact
Rick
same.
Shout out.
Yeah, oh. Copy to a Freddy Krueger ear on
it's
the
side
of her head.
It's the one you wish was on screen more, like that appliance that they put on her. Is
oh my god!
Like
oh
next
my god!
That's outstanding.
That might be my favorite Easter egg that I've heard so far.
I wanted to ask about non-scream Wes Easter eggs. You guys might have
so
worked
much.
In there.
There's a lot.
Are there really?
So many? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that there's the best one? The Freddy ear.
Gallner's tattoo on his knuckles. He has the address of the Elm Street house on his knuckles.
Who does?
Kyle Gallner. Vince.
The character Vince.
Oh, okay.
You see him just very briefly, but trying to think of other.
It's all the marquee behind Mindy. The marquee is all Wes Craven movies.
Okay.
Behind Mindy when she's on the couch is People Under the Stairs, which is also behind Randy when he's on the couch.
Okay.
In both of those.
The amount of birds we have in sound design, that was like obviously
there's lots of what's crazy
massive,
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, a massive bird watcher and a big fan of birds. Oh. So our sound designer, Karen Baker Lander, she found out all these different specific birds that he was fans of, and they're sprinkled throughout the entire movie. And I think you could really hear them at the very end. On the Four West dedication.
That's a very specific bird at the end. That was the bird that reminded him of Ohio. That was the one that he said in an interview reminded him of when he was a kid.
Oh,
wow.
Oh my
you
God.
You guys just crushed
you did your research.
Insane. That's insane. It's fun though, right? That's like what's so fun about building a universe within the Scream movie you can do all of that stuff, right? It's okay. And it's okay for people to notice it. It doesn't break the fourth wall. It just lets them into the conversation in a totally new and self-reflexive way. It's going to be hard to make something now that doesn't get to have that level of conversation with the audience, because it's just been so, it's been so fun. And there's so many opportunities to have, you know, to make things matter.
You guys really need to do a commentary track that people can listen to now in the theaters, though.
Yes.
Because I can imagine you guys want to be sitting behind people, you know, while they're watching the movie, like,
hey,
that's a Freddy Krueger ear.
I would be totally down for like a Mystery Science 3000 thing where you guys just in the fireworks pointing things out. I would totally be down for that. I had heard a story, I think when you guys were in the middle of production, that in order to sort of preserve the ending, that you guys were shooting multiple endings with different killers, or that there was going to be different variations of the script floating around. And I feel like I've heard that for some of the past Screams as well. I'm just sort of curious, were there different versions of scripts with different killers? And does everyone on set sort of have a different idea as to who the killer is?
I would say it's more from withholding. Like when we initially sent the script out, like before people would sign on, we only sent them the first three quarters of the script, and we kept Act Three to ourselves. And then as we went into production, we're like, we need to let everybody prepare. And we really built a really close knit family of everybody. And honestly, every cast member was excited for part of the game for a little bit as we got into it. Like the different meetings we'd have with different actors, like they wouldn't want to be seen in the elevator with us going up because they thought we might be conspiring, and they didn't want another cast member to see it. Everybody was like all for the fun of that. But when it comes to actually shooting multiple scenes, we didn't have that luxury. So it was more of just seeding out the different script endings and changing the killers from what we sent out around town. And
guys,
the different versions
Jack
of the script.
Quaid, like literally up until the moment we were shooting, wasn't sure if we were fucking with him or not. It was he is the one that we kind of kept doing the pivot with more than anybody because he was an easy target for it. But
what character says, like, we told you in the first 10 minutes, like right at the end, like that is exactly what you guys did.
Yeah, dude, we got it in one.
We got it in one.
He's looking for love interest. He calls stupid.
Right. He calls her dude. He calls Sam dude.
Yeah. What a douche.
Worst.
I think we have time to fit in two more. Mine's really quick. Sydney mentions her husband, Mark. Is it Mark Kincaid? And did you try to get Patrick Dempsey back?
It is Mark Kincaid, but we didn't try to get Patrick. We didn't want to go into that whole other thing, but it is Sydney married Mark Kincaid.
Gotcha. Very cool. Kevin, I figure you have the last one.
Yeah, it's just so funny. Before I get to the question, like, because the way you guys play with us is so interesting in the movie, because like you think it's Quaid right in the first 10 minutes in that scene, and then you pivot us so much. Like, I felt like a ping pong ball going back and forth, and then that's the brilliance of the film. It's always a step ahead. Like even when like Dewey starts walking towards the elevator, you're like, dude, go back and shoot him in the head. And like you, like, and then the movie goes, oh wait, we should do that. And then they go back. It's so cool how you guys play with that. I know we're talking on the week after your film opened up. It's number one, and a question that we all talk about in interviews now is sequels and what are you doing next? And I wonder this because emotionally, I told you guys this when I watched this film when I was 12. When I walked out of that theater for the first movie in '96, this was the closest I'd felt to that experience again. In the sense of like the excitement and the horror and the intensity and just how game changing it was. And just like, that's how I felt. And you guys have really made a perfect Scream film, a film that really honors the legacy of what Wes created in the first one. I'm not just saying that to blow smoke. I just genuinely believe it was just, it reminded me of being a kid again. So I wanted to ask you, would you want to do 6 knowing how like well received this was? Like, would 6 be a more of a battle, or would you be worried about it? Are you guys game for 6? Because like this movie, just like, it's called Scream, it bookends the first one, so I just wonder where you guys want to go.
We either want to do 6 or the first Stab movie that actually is the whole way through. Yeah,
we want to go to space. We want to get outer space, and then we'll drop off.
Go SpaceX.
Do you guys want to do 6 for real though?
I think we'd be honored to be a part of it. And I think the thing that we've sort of realized with this one, and we knew it to be true, but I think, you know, and certainly like as conversation about the movie has started, and, you know, people are expressing their opinions and, you know, debating the themes. I think what we're realizing is that the fun of any of these movies is that you get to use all of it, right? Like everything that we're experiencing, everything we experienced on this one, everything that is going to happen in its aftermath, it's all like part of the fabric of what maybe the next one could be. So yeah, I think that there's certainly like
all on Zoom.
How do you subvert
Zoom?
How do you subvert the thing that's now subverted? It has folded in on itself so many times, and I think for us that's just exciting. Like that feels like an opportunity to do something just even more, you know, kind of brain breaking. And
what's our last Jedi?
What's our last Jedi?
You guys don't have to take this idea, but it's one of our favorite stories of all time. James Cameron, when he pitched Aliens, and he wrote the word alien on a board, and then he put an S at the end of it, and then he put dollar signs through it. So if you guys want to make Screams, with a dollar sign. Just,
I mean, that worked out pretty well for him. So
it's free. Right. It's free. You guys have that one. So
take my money.
Thanks. Get some Mara Weaving in Scream 6.
Oh,
we would love to. We would love to.
Well, first off, guys, thanks for coming back on so quickly. And
our pleasure, guys. Thank you.
I can't imagine how hard it is, you know, to do press for a movie like this, and to hold back all
this
these spoilers.
This is like the most fun we're able to have so far, because like it's so hard not to talk about the movie, like,
sure,
you know, and the choices that we made. Now it's like, all right, cool. Now it's out there. Let's like get into it a little bit more and put our stamp on it in a different way.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think especially when like the methodology and about the making of it is a part of what the story of these movies are. Right.
Yeah.
I think that's what, if you're a fan of anything in this universe, you're also aware of all of the stories of how they got made. And, mm-hmm. and it's so that, and having that be a part of the process and the thing that you can talk about and that there's interest around is just really awesome and exciting for us.
It also helps when the movie is great. I mean, there's we can talk spoilers all day long for bad movies and I'm good. Like, that's, you know.
Sure. Yeah. And shout out to Brian Tyler, by the way, one of my favorite composers right now.
I mean, like, man. Incredible.
Yeah. Awesome.
He had a hell of a job.
He's made our last two movies really a lot better than they had any right to be. Yeah. Thank you, Brian.
Great.
Well, thank you guys for coming back on. We really appreciate it. Hopefully get to talk to you guys again soon, and continued success. Congratulations again on a terrific opening weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, guys.
Appreciate it, guys. We want to thank our friends at Paramount for giving us time with Matt and Tyler and Chad, and also to Matt, Tyler, and Chad for being tremendous guests 2 weeks in a row. Loved having those guys on. Loved diving deeper into Scream. So far, both times now that we've had them on, they've blown my mind with some type of reveal, and this one has to be the Freddy Krueger ear. Like, that's just one of the greatest stories ever. But that, I said that in the interview, and I really did mean that. Like, when you're a director who puts in some sort of detail like that, that the general audience might not catch. Like, isn't that annoying? Don't you want to sit in the theater and like point it out to different people?
Well, think about like Jordan Peele. Like, I remember thinking about, because Get Out is filled with so many little things that you don't pick up on the first time you watch it, or the second time, or the third time. And I remember talking to Jordan Peele for Us. I kind of asked that question. I'm like, is there a certain level of restraint that you have as a filmmaker, knowing you have something brilliant that you're saying in a scene, but most people might not get it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and like, and it is an interesting thing, because to me, that's pure talent. Like, if you're able to, if you have a great idea, and then you can restrain yourself in a way that you, like 90% of people who watch this movie are probably not going to see this or get this.
Yeah.
But then you have people who dive in to Get Out like 7-8 times like I have, and it's so rewarding. But you're right, though. It is fascinating. Like, if you think about someone watching the Scream movie once and then never seeing it again and never knowing that Freddy Krueger's ear is on.
I mean, we never would have. I could have watched the movie 1,000 times. There's no way I would have.
And so, like, that's called restraint. And it's to me, that's talent, because you have a brilliant idea. If you think about all the things in Get Out that are like go unsaid, or like little details that he puts in there for multiple viewings, it's just insane. It's insane.
It's almost like when you buy someone a really great Christmas gift, but you have to wait like 8 weeks to give it to them. Isn't there a part of you that's like, you just want to be like, can I just give it to you right now, or can I just tell you what I bought you? It's the worst.
And then you give it to them and they're like, cool.
Cool, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks. Nice.
This is great, thanks.
Okay. But it is crazy to think about when you put something like crazy in
my favorite movie on VHS.
People...
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I still have Dunkirk on VHS upstairs.
Mine's up here. Mine's on the shelf somewhere over here.
I see it every day.
By the way, I'm doing a deep dive clean of the office. If I tilted the camera down, you guys would feel like I'm in a hoarder house.
You don't need to tilt the camera down for us to
That is kind of like the cleanest area also.
Jason, what's the guy's name from Tommy, Pam and Tommy? He's down there.
He might be down
That's
there
right.
with Jason his voice with three assistants moving it around. The blend game. We are playing superhero theme blend, and I'm starting with Kevin McCarthy to tell me what your favorite superhero theme is.
Controversial one.
Can I guess?
You can guess if you want. Yeah, sure.
Is yours Zimmer's Man of Steel theme?
It is.
Oh, damn. Why is that controversial?
It's a terrific theme. I think it's my favorite superhero theme of all time, and controversial because that movie is very divisive. Okay. Snyder is very divisive. I could see somebody listening to this and screaming like, "How the hell could you not choose John Williams's theme from the first Superman?" So, like, I think at the end of the day, I think this speaks generationally here. Okay. As much as I admire John Williams's theme for Superman, I'm a fan of other John Williams's scores more than I am of his Superman theme. Zimmer's theme for Superman, like before we had Hans Zimmer on our show, Zimmer came on for Dune. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back and check it out.
It's okay.
And it always been my favorite of superhero themes. But then when Zimmer explained it, it just opened it up even more. Like, there's a great part of that interview where he talks about the choices that he uses, why the sounds are the way they are. It's not even just a single particular piece of music. It's the whole theme. It's the whole movie. As the film gets more aggravated and more intense, that heavy drum style, that like really, really in your face, like, that's definitely a Nolan style of using score, like really like making it part of the world and environment and as a leading character. Not that people haven't done that before, But Nolan, I feel like should get some credit for the way he's utilized Zimmer over the years with The Dark Knight and obviously Dunkirk and everything he's done. But Man
I'm stunned
of Steel,
you didn't pick The Dark Knight, actually. I thought The Dark Knight theme was going to be.
The Dark Knight's a tough one because you can arguably say that the music was already written for Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. And then like that main like dun, dun, dun. Like the, mm-hmm. there's so many. I mean, and then you could argue the Joker's theme, the D note. I mean, those are great themes. No, don't get me wrong. No question. But like after I heard Man of Steel, it was over. Because like there was just something so full and heartfelt about that piece of music. Just in simple piano notes, and then using it for also the way Snyder shot Man of Steel, like it was very documentary. Like if you watch that movie closely, the camera is always searching for Superman. Mm. Like if you watch like the camera, it's almost like moving in a way where it's like trying to help you find Superman in his quick flight, which I think is really a cool idea because he's so fast that like it probably would be impossible for someone to capture that, you know what I mean? And like, and so for the music to combine with that, and then when he starts flying for the first time, like, you know, it just like, ugh, it's one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, not just superhero theme, but like it is just masterful. And it just like makes me feel something. The music itself brings me to the world of the movie without the movie. And I think that's the key to a great score. If you hear the Star Wars theme, you hear the Indiana Jones theme, you're immediately transported to the world. You hear Howard Shore's Lord of the Rings theme, you're immediately transported to the world. When I hear Man of Steel, I'm in that world. I'm with Cavill. I'm feeling his emotion and his insecurities and his vulnerabilities and his rage. It's brilliant.
Well, coincidentally, I went with the John Williams one.
I know you did.
and you might be right. Maybe it's just a generational thing. And I will say that I have come a lot further into the Zimmer camp of how fantastic that score. And only because I was immersed in those movies while writing the Snyder Cut book. And he, like you said, hearing him talk about the breakdown of the very simple piano to reflect his Kansas time and building to the use of drums. But I can't not, like, I've made the argument on this show many times that the Superman theme is my choice for the best thing that John Williams has done. And that's kind of crazy to say that when you talk about the number of things that he has accomplished. But there's nothing more triumphant than that score. It's... You know, and Zimmer even talks about this a little bit in the interview of like the challenge of writing a theme for a character as iconic as Superman. And what I love about John Williams' score and a lot of his earlier stuff, whether it's Indiana Jones or Star Wars or Superman, is that people paid or gave a lot more credit to and attention to a score. In an earlier, because people had themes, you know, I think we're through a period now where characters, signature characters, don't necessarily come with iconic themes that you would immediately associate with them when you heard them. And
that's
John
why
Williams
Far From
was
Home was smart
at that.
Because you hear Strange's theme come in, like you know that, like that picking of the instrument, like oh that's Strange. We're outside of. I didn't mean to cut you off, but like they do that well.
I went back for round four of No Way Home, and it's as subtle as like just any at the end of the third act when Ned opens a portal and Doctor Strange walks through it. Giacchino plays his theme, and it puts you right back into it. But as a sort of aside to that, when Giacchino had to come up with a theme for Homecoming, he riffs the '60s cartoon because of how prevalent themes were back in the day. So there's two big segments to the Superman theme song. There's the which is the, I mean, again, you hear it and you,
my God,
it
make,
I get goosebumps and I want to, yes, I really do. And then there's a dun 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 dun. Like they're both just like you want to rip your shirt open and reveal the ass underneath, or it's tremendous. And so I had to go with that, and but Kevin, I'm with you as well too. The Zimmer Man of Steel is fantastic. So Jakey, break the tie. Who'd you go with?
I think this blend game is one of the most. It's the blend game that for a long time in a while I think that really relies on us differentiating favorite from best.
Hmm.
And because we're talking superheroes, which is obviously a big part of like us growing up, for me, my pick is all about like my childhood. So I chose Danny Elfman's Batman theme.
Hmm.
Because when I hear that theme, not even so much like, oh, it takes me back to those movies, Tim Burton's first two films, which it absolutely does. It takes me back to a different part of my life.
Mm.
Like I hear, da na 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 na, and I remember like my parents taking me to McDonald's over and over again so I could try to collect all the Batman Returns Happy Meal toys. I remember, you know, going to the video store to, you know, and convincing my, please, mom, buy Batman for me on tape. Like, cause you know, buying a tape, you know, it was a big deal back then. And so it's one thing to hear music and have it associated with, you know, a character or a film, but to have it transport you in time to a different place, a different like memory, a different time in your life. I just think is incredibly powerful. And that's what Danny Elfman's, Batman theme does. I will say hearing Zimmer's score, particularly you put it in your ear pods and you walk around the city of Chicago. That's a pretty cool feeling. I've actually done that a couple of times. But nothing does what Elfman's score for me. So that's why I'm relying on really favorite. If I had to choose best, I actually probably would choose Williams' Superman theme. But if we're going favorite, which is why I love this game, then I'm going Elfman's Batman.
And Elfman was on our show, by the way. If anyone hasn't heard that interview, he came on. Was it for Dumbo?
Yes, it was.
And he took a really deep dive in his career. We talked Spider-Man. We talked Batman. I want to say came up. I know Darkman.
Nightmare Before Christmas.
So if you never heard our Elfman interview, it was a really cool to kind of like deep dive in his career. So.
Kevin, I just wish you liked Nightmare Before Christmas. I just wish you would give it a shot. I don't know why you hate that movie so much.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, if I ever get two dogs, I would name them Jack and Sally, probably.
Janelle says either Danny Elfman's Batman or, good one, Michael Giacchino's The Incredibles. That's a really great theme. Jim McCann, Brian, and many others went with John Williams' Superman. Christian Williams said Shang-Chi from Joel P. West.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, James Vasquez says Flight from Man of Steel, and Jeff Maimon says the DCU Wonder Woman theme, also Hans Zimmer.
Which is
Sean Hans.
Is incredible.
Yes, what?
They used it a lot in the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, yeah,
that's like, a good
like,
piece of music.
Almost too much. Like she sneezed, and then it'd be like...
Now, Zimmer and Junkie XL both get credit for that, right?
Yeah,
or is that Zimmer alone?
No, it's Junkie. That's a lot of Junkie. The Wonder Woman one is Zimmer with the guitar.
Okay,
the guitar riff, but then Junkie sort of built on it for Snyder Cut.
I am surprised that, and Sean, I know how much you love Superman. I am surprised that no one picked Silvestri's Avengers theme.
It's a great one
because that is like
it's good. That is a great. I thought about that one.
That's pretty like iconic.
I'd almost put, if I remember correctly, it kind of shares some motifs with Avengers. Giacchino's Spider-Man.
Yeah, I know.
Above
the
Avengers, I think, for me, even.
It's hard because my only critique about the Marvel scores is that they're similar. When I hear them, I know exactly what it is.
It feels like they share a world together, though, which I like. That's how I always do it. Like the way Spider-Man's,
is that
when I hear
boring
it.
Boring themes?
All right. But when you when you hear Spider-Man, it evokes the Avengers, which is great because that's how he was brought in. Like it feels like he's a part of that world and that team. I like that.
So for next week, we're gonna get
a graceful one next week.
We're gonna continue. We're gonna continue the meta conversation that's been sprung from the world of Scream and the deep dive references that the Scream directors worked into their franchise. Next week's blend game is hashtag real blend, where you are going to, for the 200th episode, you're going to let us know via hashtag real blend, or sending us an email at realblend@cinemablend.com, your favorite real blend interview from the first 199.
Question. What if we open that up to the listeners? Real blend moment. They can just share a story from, there's like great arguments. There's all kind of, what if we just,
I'm okay with that. I'm all right with that.
Favorite real blend moment.
Favorite Real Blend moments.
Whether it's an interview or a discussion or
what the all right, well, I gotta binge. Real Blend Lent. Episode one.
No, please don't. Start around 60. That's when we started to figure out what we were doing. While you are going back through the previous 199 episodes and remembering all the entertainment that we have brought you guys over the years, leave us a review, please. Go over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can leave us a star rating on Spotify. We're going to be recording our next premium episode. We're playing the IMDb game once again, despite the fact that I hate that game and I don't think there's any skill to it.
You don't hate the game. You just hate losing the game, which
I
you do.
Hate losing the game. It's very true.
So you probably hate a lot.
You can get access to... Oh, and also, people were sharing on the Facebook chat page for Real Blend that they really enjoyed the draft, the 2022 movie draft, and they were saying that if you want to listen to the movie draft conversation and all the other fun things that we do on premium, go to cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. In the meantime, follow... Oh, shoot. I wanted to go back and listen to last week's episode because I came up with something that I was going to shout. What am I going to shout at the end of this episode? Gabe, do you remember?
I thought we had to say the Batman because...
Oh, that's right. Thank you. Okay, so yes. Okay, so you can follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. Yes, Gabe.
And a final reminder, next week, Friday, we are on Cinema Blend's Instagram. We are going live to celebrate episode 200, a fun little after party at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. Apologies if you are in a time zone that's at a wild hour. We love you all the same.
Well, that's at like 11 UK, right? That's not too bad.
Could be. I think that's right.
We're worth staying up for. We are absolutely worth staying because Jake's going to get a tattoo.
Come hang out. If it's fun, if people enjoy it and people want to keep doing it, maybe we'll do more of them. But we'll see you guys next week for that. Anyway, until next time.
The Batman!
Hubie!
Jesus Christ.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.